everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast about the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balavanian, and with me today, our special guest is Lucas Risotto, a creative technologist and the founder of Where Thoughts Go, which just released on the Oculus Store, actually. Hi, Lucas.
Hello, everyone.
And, of course, beaming in from Germany, we have Mr. Peter Leckoff.
Yeah, well, hello. I am slightly annoyed by virtual reality because I've been doing a whole workshop today and nothing was working perfect, but somehow better than I expected. So I'm sitting in a very hot Berlin flat and hope I can do today fine without the headset overheating because it warned me already.
Well, I hope you stay in this conversation.
Yeah, I'm the opposite, actually. I haven't been, ironically, I've been, even though I've been developing virtual reality applications, I haven't touched a VR headset in 2 weeks. It's good to be back. I also broke my Rift, but that's a different conversation.
Oh, maybe we should have that conversation. What happened?
So I've been rebuilding a lot of the stuff that I was working on over the past couple of months, and building outside of VR at the moment, it can be faster than building things with a VR heavy workflow. So there's a lot of work that you can get done, especially in the early parts of a project. If you have debugging tools that work with mouses and keyboards, you can save a lot of time not having to put on the headset on and off to test every single feature. So I've been trying to actually to speed up development by allowing you to develop with as little VR as possible until you get to the interaction stuff and the stuff that's really VR dependent.
How do you do it? Do you do unit tests or do you some kind of other type of testing?
Debug log.
I wish I had the discipline for unit testing. It doesn't go that far, especially I'm actually a designer that learned coding over the past 2 years. I've been thrown into the tech landscape by necessity. I just needed to know these skills to build the things I wanted to build. I do it mostly through custom editor scripts. So every single thing you can test by pressing a button, every single behavior, every single feature. And
that's cute.
It's been working pretty well. Oh, is it cute? Like, look at this designer trying to
I mean, if you don't have a team of 10 people, unit tests just don't make sense, right? I mean, I would assume that this, particularly for rapid prototyping, I mean, the worst thing you can do is, you know, sit for 2 days or 2 weeks and, you know, define your unit test before you actually start coding, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know.
But it's been great. It's really good to rebuild everything after you actually learn how things work at a deeper level.
Speaking of how things work, so I guess let's talk a little bit about yourself. We'll talk about Where Thoughts Go. But I guess before we do that, why don't you give us a little bit of a background about who you are and where you're coming from? Perhaps you talked a little bit about being a designer. Before VR, what kind of field were you into?
Oh my God. So my background is a huge mess, which actually I think makes me really equipped to work in VR because it's such a multidisciplinary field. I worked with events, like throwing parties for a living. I worked doing photography and video and music. And it's like every 2 years, I always found myself doing something completely different. And 3 years ago, I moved into the US, New York specifically, and I started... I was doing graphic design a year before, so I started transitioning into UI design. And from UI design, I started to transition into programming and development. And that's about the time where I discovered that virtual reality was a thing and that programming was not just like was not something just reserved for geniuses. Mm. And I was like, oh, wow, there's so much you can do with this. And first time I tried VR, I cried and I decided to pursue it, and I just like dropped everything
that
I was doing.
Try?
So it was actually two things. I tried the gallery that was back in 2015, so it was before its release. It was like an early version, and the portal demo, the one with the GLaDOS, the very basic portal demo. This was still the HTC prototype era. It wasn't even out, and I wasn't crying because it was a particularly emotional storyline or anything like that. It was just, I was just overwhelmed by the amount of things I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's what I chased with my work. I chased new feelings. Like I want people to feel something new and technology to challenge them to do something that they never thought technology would ask of them. That's kind of like the the common thread between all the projects I made that I really like.
Is feeling an emotion.
It's feeling something new. It's like, oh, wow. Mm. I don't know what this is, suffering. But it's new. You could design suffering. This is something I think about a lot. Like, what does that look like? Especially when brain interfaces become a thing. But yeah, designing pain is complicated, especially legally. Not good for a startup.
That was your inner literary Russian writer coming out and pursuing the first emotion.
Yeah, eternal suffering. Yes, it's from Russia. With suffer in me, in my heart.
Yeah, I was actually meeting with a lot of indie Polish developers over the past couple of weeks, and I realized how much of them make dystopian war games. I was like, oh, wow.
That's interesting.
And some of the best, actually, dystopian war games come from Poland, and it makes a lot of sense when you think about it.
Well, actually, I don't know of any examples that come to mind.
This War of Mine was from a Polish studio. The game Observer, which is also it's a Blade Runner esque dystopian game. There's like a list. It's really interesting. It's interesting how history can affect what an indie game studio does 60 years later.
Right, like the cultural history and like, you know, what they
exactly.
What a culture values or like the emotions that they have that are more accessible, perhaps. Yeah, that is really interesting. And you can expect like California stuff to always be sunny and bright and happy and glamoury and vanity based. But maybe that's true. Definitely more upbeat, that's for sure. And I think a lot of American things are usually optimistic and... So, Lucas, let's talk a little bit about where thoughts go. I believe you were a part of Boost VC's last Tribe.
Yes, that is correct. Tribe 12.
I'm probably thinking some
maybe
people
could explain what Boost VC is.
So, Boost VC is an accelerator program that's focused particularly in virtual reality and in blockchain companies. They do take some other companies as well, but it's the general focus is VR and blockchain. And yeah, the way that it works is that if you get accepted and if you accept to join the accelerator, you move into San Mateo, which is like at the heart of Silicon Valley. And for 3 months, you're given housing and mentorship and you have time structure and a little bit of money to build your product. And you can have housing actually for up to 4 or 5 months, depending on what time of the year. So it's a good way to get projects running and to get a bunch of people working in the same space. And actually, I was surprised at how useful it is to be in a basement with like 10 other VR companies. So you can just share resources and contacts and lessons and struggles of doing VR in 2018. So it's been a really interesting experience.
Which stage have your project have been when you actually applied for Boost VC?
I had a prototype running of Where Thoughts Go, the thing that we were going to premiere at Tribeca in April. But the thing with Boost is that I'd say it's even less about stage and it's more about the people. They very much invest in people. And I'm not even sure to what extent the people at Boost knew what I was doing. They just knew that it was something interesting. And they had a bunch of people from Boost who are other founders that vouched for me. And I think that was the key reason I got in. And you can definitely get in by having like beautiful pitch decks and having, you know, a solid plan or traction. But if you're doing something interesting and you're passionate and you have people that can vouch for you, you can definitely also get into the accelerator program because ultimately it's less about what you're doing and it's more about the people doing it.
So maybe another question, because it might be maybe for some importance to anyone who's listening. So I've been recently to a ViveX meetup, and my question would be, how did you choose Boost VC? So there are a lot of accelerator programs, right? And Boost VC is not the only one centered around VR. What was your motivation?
Several. Number one, I really like the idea of living here in the Silicon Valley, even if it's for a brief period of time. I'm probably going to stay here for a full year. It just really got me. It got me immersed in the tech landscape to a level that I wasn't exposed to before. Being able to get like a 10-minute drive to visit, you know, people at Google, or to talk with the guys from the Oculus hardware team directly, is a really different kind of relationship than what I was used to in the past. So that was one of the appeals. The second one is I had several friends who did boost companies, and they only had good things to say. And that was actually like, I was actually getting pissed off after a while, because I was interviewing as many founders as I could. And I was like, does anyone have something bad to say about this place? Because it's like, it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. But nobody could tell me anything bad. And it was, other investors recommended it as well. And so it's, and it was also good timing. I was just done with college back in January. I wanted to go straight into doing something that I loved and something I was excited about. And the boost program started literally like a month after I graduated. So it was like great timing.
Hey, we've had a few companies that were coming out of Boost as well. We've had Realities.io on. Who else? Let me think. I think there was Tribe 4 or 5.
Fishbowl.
That's right, Fishbowl VR. I actually befriended probably 80 to 90% of the founders from One Tribe, because that was initially the time I was going into the VR industry. And like they have actually become some of my closest friends, even though I wasn't in the accelerator. I wasn't in this tribe with people. I didn't build a company there, but like, I don't know. They had a way of attracting really awesome people together. And I think based on what you're talking about with having, you know, a basement and also the living space be very much tied to this 3-month acceleration, like it creates really strong bonds. So I think, did you have a positive experience after the fact, or were there, if you're looking for bad things and you couldn't find bad things and that other founders were saying, did you find bad things that came out of there, or like, how would you describe that?
So what was the question with the bad things? I just didn't quite.
How was your experience with Boost VC after the fact as well?
I mean, it was exactly what I was expecting. So there was no problems with that. I was pleasantly surprised at how being with other founders in a shared space helps you shape your product. Just like being able to borrow, you know, other founders for a minute to test your product, and we're like, what do you think of this and that? And you create this network of support and this culture of support that's really strong. And those are the people you go to war with at the end, like as allies, not enemies. So I feel like I can count on the founders I spent those 3 months with, and whenever I need help or contacts or whatever it is, I can reach out to them and they will help me as much as I will help them. So it's been a positive experience. Living here is great. The fact that it's, you know, the housing is literally, you cross the street and you're in the office, you're working alongside other passionate people, because in VR, you have to be either passionate or stupid, or a mixture of both, to be in it, because there's no money in it. There's a promise of something much larger that can lead to money. But people in VR who are in VR are usually not after money directly. They're after something something else that's more meaningful.
Right. So it's much more of a long-term game. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
I should also mention Adam Draper, I think one of the lead investors at Boost, also does a podcast called the Boost VC Podcast. I listen to it pretty frequently. Pretty nice resource as well for founders that are kind of interested in listening to companies and talk to an investor and kind of digging in. They don't have like the same science and the design aspect of covering VR as we do, and they also cover blockchain things. But it's definitely a podcast that I would recommend. We're really sounding like an advertisement today for Boost, but
yeah, somehow we are. I mean, I have also a story with Boost, so
disclaimer. Okay. I'm still like at Boost, living under their roof. Adam, if you're listening to this, you're great. I love this. This is great. Great.
Well, I have also to do a disclaimer. I was once in Boost and they kicked me out like after one talk, so it's fine. I love them. Oh. They were honest.
But kicked you out after one talk. What do you mean? What was it like? What kind of?
No, I was trying to pitch them our company that I'm working for, and they don't invest in corporates.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Which I found out during the talk, but the guy was very nice and explained me a lot of stuff, so I'm very thankful.
Okay, cool. Just one thing to touch. The only thing about Boost that founders really need to be thoughtful of is that it's great depending on the stage you're in, right? If if the amount of funding and the experience of being exposed to this world, plus, you know, having this shared experience with other founders, sounds like something meaningful to you, it's great. If you're in it just for the money, there's probably better ways of handling this than just, you know, taking the money and going. It's really about the whole experience. And for me, it was particularly meaningful because I've heard a lot about startups, but there's a lot of I didn't know about them. And being at Boost helped me demystify what a startup is.
Right.
Like now I understand all moving parts, like everything from legal to financing to everything.
Once when I was at Plug and Play, I forgot what the name of the founder is, but he was giving a talk and he said that, you know, when he wants startups, he wants them to be 3 months in San Francisco and then they can do whatever they want because some kind of applied MBA. So would you describe your experience in Boost as some kind of startup applied MBA?
Yeah, it feels like it. I feel like I know how the tech industry operates at a much deeper level now. And I know how startups work at a much deeper level. And it's like, I am more equipped to deal with this world. If I had skipped the accelerator stage, I would probably make a ton of mistakes.
What kind of mistakes?
Simple things that can destroy you down the road, not being mindful about a couple of legal things and not being mindful about how funding operates at a... most of the heaviest mistakes are when it comes to really legal, but and taxes, right. And it's just those things that are easy to overlook when you're too focused on building a product. But here I was constantly reminded by others that, oh no, dude, you should do that like now. And I'm like, okay.
So Lucas, can you tell us a little bit about Where Thoughts Go? What is it
so
exactly?
I'm going to be talking about Where Thoughts Go Prologue, which is the thing that kickstarted this whole thing. And basically, Where Thoughts Go is a social VR experience set in a world where human thoughts exist in as sleeping creatures you can interact with. Each one of them is a voice message left by another user who was there before you were. So you travel through these virtual worlds in which you're surrounded by the intimate thoughts of other users. And each world asks you a personal question. You can wake up these thoughts to listen to the messages that people left behind. And to progress in the narrative that is Prologue, you need to give birth to your own creatures, record a message of your own, and leave your story behind for others to find. So it's like it's an ever-growing landscape of human stories, and it's all anonymous, and it's all done in VR for full emotional effect.
I think I've heard you describe it as a VR social network for emotions. Is that an accurate assessment? For emotions. I could see you're struggling.
I'm being careful about the words I used to describe this because it's changing a lot internally. But it definitely has those qualities. It is technically a social network, and it is technically it is very emotional, but I'm just being careful about how I describe it for now, because the product is changing a lot.
Cool. But I guess tell us, the product is released, that is on the Oculus Home Store. Is it also on Steam?
So we released an early access version in the Oculus Store, and it is going to be on Steam and Windows Mixed Reality and other high-end VR platforms probably by the first week of August. We're finishing that right now, and we're working on other installments that can go beyond those platforms as well. And hopefully we'll get to the Oculus Go and the HTC Focus sometime later this year.
Cool. Maybe you can describe...
And that's for Prologue. Yeah.
Okay. So this is the early access Prologue version. Perhaps you can describe kind of the user experience of, you know, let's say one of our listeners right now downloaded the app. What do you do? What is the first thing that you kind of encounter? Do you start listening to people's memories and messages, or do you have to leave a memory behind before you hear any other memories?
So the way that it works is that upon entering the application, you're transported to a virtual world in which you're surrounded by little sleeping creatures. A prompt appears in front of you, asking you a particularly personal question. You can choose to record your answer immediately and leave it behind, or you can also choose to listen to other people first and record whenever you're comfortable. So you wake up these creatures, and the environment kind of like closes in on you. You get to listen to their story. And once it's finished, the creature floats away. And it's what's particularly interesting about this is that because it's intimate and because it's built in this virtual reality setting, it feels like a safe, anonymous space where you can have certain conversations and talk about things that you usually don't talk about in the real world. So the kind of conversations that you have in this space, they're really raw and really thoughtful and really intimate. And people share things that they don't usually share on the internet. And it's really what drew me into this. I was being consistently surprised by the things people say. So in Prologue, you travel through a lot of worlds like this. And by the end of chapter 5, something happens. I don't want to spoil it, but there's a little twist.
Okay. Cool. In terms of conversations that you just mentioned, I mean, how does that work? Is it an asynchronous way of like you can respond, you can leave a response to a specific creature or a message that you listen to? Or
yeah, perhaps the term conversation is actually inappropriate. You don't leave responses. People share their stories and
I see. Okay.
They exist on their own. We have thought about responses and what's a thoughtful way of doing it, but we haven't found the perfect way of doing it, and we're only
a big like button. A big like button?
No, I hate buttons, yeah. And I hate two-dimensional interfaces, and we can talk about that because I think that Werthasko has a very, very unique approach to UI that I'm totally on board with. But yeah, like button is exactly not the way to do it, I would say.
You know, I like this concept because this is almost kind of like a two modes of I don't want to say social networking, but like of putting content out there on certain platforms that invites people to engage with it, right? It's Facebook where you can like and comment or like react and you post things with the expectation that you're expecting a response from your audience. And then there's other content or other platforms where you put something out there without actually people being able to respond to it. And the only metric you can kind of look at is like, have people seen it? And so I think this really changes behavior, right? Like on certain platforms, when you are expecting response, I think that will change what you will write or that will, perhaps you'll omit certain details or you'll omit things from actually posting because you're like, my audience won't like this. They won't respond to it. It won't get liked as much versus let's think of like an Instagram story or a Snapchat story. You put something out there as like something, this is silly. I don't care if people, you know, would like this or not, because guess what? They can't really like it. Like, or at least like with a button, which leads to like, I think more, let's say raw form of content or like you don't have to curate it as much. I'm a fan of kind of like thinking of networks in this kind of paradigm. Like what kind of interactions does this thing merit?
Yeah, with the mention of like Instagram and Facebook, I feel like they have created some pretty bad feedback loops unintentionally that skewed user behavior to a really bad degree. So like it's the when you're adding a like mechanism, you kind of like you create a like economy that dictates what content is good and what content is bad.
Right,
and
right.
It was already shown that like that there's a ton of research that shows this. If people post something and it doesn't get likes, they feel actual guilt. A lot of people will feel compelled to delete the content 5 minutes afterwards if it doesn't get immediate approval. And you're basically telling indirectly your audience that the algorithms define what content is good and bad, and people take it personally. It's like if you post a photo and it doesn't get any likes, you're taking that as an assessment as the world rejects what this photo represents and the world rejects you. And I am, and those feedback systems actually are the things that created echo chambers in social media, and I really don't want to create those. So we opted for the simplest approach right now, which is just record and go. And you can't even listen to the stuff you've recorded, which was something that we were there was some debate about. But it's the fact that you cannot listen. It's hard on the first time, but then you get used to it. It's really so you never have the opportunity to self-censor. You just get used to the act of talking and leaving.
I have a question. So apparently, from what I've been reading recently, actually by chance, not on purpose, you can identify a person by its voice print. So you said that it's anonymous, but are you somehow reverbing the voice or make it, you know, not being able to being detected by algorithms to be, you know, assessed to a certain person?
No, not at the moment.
Maybe the question is like, how anonymous do you care this content to be? Or like, I think that's a good point, right? Like if you want to go and reverse engineer something and see who posted that, perhaps like if it's like incriminating, like, I don't know. Do you want this to be a fully anonymous platform, or do you want to, let's say, de-anonymize, like have it be less anonymous than what Facebook or Twitter is, so that people end up sharing things that are more intimate? Because it sounds like this is a much more intimate place that you want to be in, much more emotion based, right?
Yeah, and this is actually my vision for the company as a whole. It's not just what we really want to unlock is those kinds of emotional interactions between people. And create products using whichever medium and technology that really, really that can create these powerful connections that technology has, for the most part, failed to do. As in for how anonymous it is, yes, there is technology that can identify voices, but it's in we do want to, in future versions, to start doing like pitch shifting. The problem with pitch shifting is that it can detract too much from the performance. Like if people start sounding inhumane, you start to have a problem, because then people are going to be feel less compelled to connect and to share. And it's going to feel like everyone's hiding. And one of the key things about Where Thoughts Go is that even though it is, you don't know the names of the people, where they're from and what they look like, it feels like everyone is opening up more than they are hiding. So we want to do pitch shifting, but want to make sure that it's something that it doesn't detract from the experience and that it's invisible. Like you can't even notice it. And the technology exists, but I don't think it is it exists at a point in which it really is a huge problem. And, you know, like if you've played games for a while, you probably have met in an online game, like a Morgan Freeman impersonator. how does the algorithm distinguish from a good Morgan Freeman impersonator versus actual Morgan Freeman? And it doesn't seem to do that well yet.
I have another question. Who is owning the content? So let's say a big problem that people usually have with Facebook or Instagram is that in the terms, you usually have to give away the rights on the pictures that the platform can use for whatever purposes. So you'd mentioned that I can't even listen to my own recording.
Yeah.
So how much do I own it?
I mean, because we are a truly anonymous platform, every time we start up, like we show like the terms of service and stuff. So to ensure that it's that everybody has the opportunity to read it, and it essentially grants us license to use the audio recordings within the experience. Like this is, we need that to show you other people's messages. However, it describes in great detail what data is used and what data isn't. So like we have no identifying data beyond your voice. I guess if you use some advanced voice recognition algorithm, we can't stop people from recognizing your voice. But in a platform like this, it's terribly unlikely. And we try to design things like you listen to a message and it drifts away and you can't really listen to it again. So it's really, really hard to identify someone to the point that we feel comfortable putting this out there. But no identifying data. We don't sell that to anyone. We don't share that to anyone. It's really all we ask is for like unlimited license to show it to other people.
And can I delete it afterwards when I don't like it for some reason, like 1 year after?
That's the thing. It is truly anonymous. So it's not tied to any account whatsoever. Uh-huh. There's no user accounts. And which is interesting, right? Because I started realizing that people for something like this, they want something truly anonymous, but it does come with a couple of trade-offs if you're truly being anonymous, like if you're not bullshitting them. And in our case, that's the case. But because it is truly anonymous, once something is out there, it's out there.
Well, you could use some kind of open public and private PGP key so people could sign it and later revoke it, but I don't think at this stage it makes sense. So sure, makes sense.
Yeah. Maybe in the future, but right now we're just like taking precautions to make sure that there's like, we just want to preserve that, like in doubt, preserve anonymity. And this is what we're doing right now.
So two questions. I think One question that kind of came to mind is like, if there's someone that you're listening to and they're talking about something, I don't know, personal to them, and you almost want to follow, if they're posting a new thought every day, is there a way of like kind of following their journey and seeing if their thoughts and emotions are changing, or by being truly anonymous, you're kind of, you're just listening to things, and there you don't really want to have people have, let's say, followers of a certain voice or a certain story?
I am definitely really compelled to do that. It's something I've been thinking about a lot, on what's the best way to approach it. So right now, Where Thoughts Go does a great job of connecting you with like with the minds of the world and the emotions of the world as a whole. But I think for future things that we release later this year and next year, I think being able to, as you're having your own journey, to basically select the characters of your story in a very indirect and subtle way, and basically seeing the arc of some people, like the character arc of other people, like take its complete as well as alongside yours, is very interesting. I do have some worries about how do you approach this in a way that it's like, if you're listening to multiple things about someone, does the person become identifiable? So it's something that like we're thinking about, how do we structure this in a way that it gives you, it enhances that one-to-one connection, but it also does not expose someone. Unless, of course, you know, if you want to, I guess, record a message saying where you are and where you're from, it's your choice. But yeah, I'm just trying to be careful about that. Yeah, anonymity
factor.
What about
an anonymity? How do you say the word? God.
Anonymity.
Anonymity. Let's go with that. What about it is so compelling for you to really try to base an entire network off of that? Like, why does it have to be anonymous?
There's a principle in quantum physics that when you observe reality, it changes, right?
So that's a misnomer, I'd say, because it's not the act of observing, but it's the act of measuring changes the results. Yes. Yeah,
exactly. The act of measuring, and in I would say that people work in a similar way, in the sense that when we know we're being observed, we act in a very, very particularly different way. When we are in a social situation, or even when you are with a close friend in the room, you do not act and think in the same way as when you're alone and when you feel truly unobserved and truly anonymous. And this is something that I noticed early on, is that when people were alone, having the experience alone in a locked room, messages would be much longer, much more thoughtful. They would open up. They would have a much deeper emotional connection with the content, and everything would just become better. But if they had anyone next to them, it doesn't matter how close the person was, messages would be shorter. They would be a little wittier. They would joke more. They start to do a performance. They stop thinking about just themselves and having that moment in which they go into their own minds and have an emotional journey. And they're thinking about the people around them, and their social behavior changes because of it. So I wanted to create, I use the isolationist aspects of VR, actually, which VR is often criticized for, but it can be a huge asset to get people to feel isolated and to go to a place in which they can have a particular type of behavior that they often cannot have in the real world. And I think anonymity plays a huge role in getting people to, like, you can say whatever you actually feel here, and there's no judgment, there's no reason not to do it. It's an opportunity.
There's no reputation either. Absolutely. Right? That seems to be like one of the building blocks, is that when you're not worried about reputation, or, you know, about history of a certain person, then you're less concerned about trying to craft a specific narrative.
Yeah, and it fits very nicely into the era of post-privacy, where people just basically are forced towards, you know, being open and do an act all the time. But somehow, I guess, one could argue that your app gives this free window of opportunity for the soul to shine through, right?
Yeah.
And to be actually yourself.
I don't think I agree with that, though, Peter. Like, I don't think we're in a post-privacy world. We are in a post-privacy world, but I don't think the effect of that is that we are more open. I think we're way more guarded of our true intentions and feelings.
Yes.
Because we have such exposed, like, we are so exposed online. I think that's probably where we are
fake,
online.
Fake openness or like...
Not fake, but maybe fake openness in a way to like, let's say, to agree with people that you don't really agree with. But like, I think we're much more guarded.
Post a salad that you might not like, but you might expect likes for it.
Yeah. I mean, that I think you would call that like moral posturing, right? It's like if you want to say something for the sake of like seeming that you're agreeing with the right group people for whatever opinion. But we're for sure not in a, I mean, maybe we'll get to that point where like, let's say if someone, I don't know if this was a South Park, I guess kind of it's tied to South Park, but like if everyone's browsing history is suddenly open, it's like, and everyone's like, yeah, everyone's, you know, viewing history is open, then do we suddenly become like, oh, you know what, fuck it, we're all, looks like everyone is into crazy things, and so we're all going to be open. I don't know if that's exactly the future, but
yeah, but then the magic around this forbidden fruit can also be going away, right?
That would be
your thoughts
if that happened. If everyone's histories became public, there would be a couple years of deep cultural and like societal chaos and confusion. It's like you would have the
a couple years for sure,
like the whole world would mature together, and they would kind of like figure out, okay, people work in this certain way, and this is how people work, and like that's, you have to redesign a new normal at a societal level, which is harsh. It could be good, but it could also, I don't know, like what kinds of war could come from this,
right?
Definitely that there would be war coming from this. It would be pretty chaotic, but I wonder at what point. It's funny, I defend privacy so adamantly, but I do wonder whether it is us trying to hold privacy is about lack of transparency, like inherently, and I wonder to what extent this is worth protecting. I protect it adamantly, right. But I just think it's like, would we benefit as a species in 200 years if we were always all the time on the same page on everything? And I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, if you would be mature enough, right? If you would be just mature enough as a society, it might be beneficial. But at the current state, I also see only war and chaos.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be a lot of chaos for a little while. So there's a transition into that world.
I think it's also super dependent too on like which part of the world you're in. Like, I think Americans are very, very concerned about privacy, and I'd say less so in other countries, depending on the culture and how kind of culture treats individuality versus collectivism.
Yeah,
I think there's so it's hard to kind of like have a one model fit everyone. But another question comes to mind, and perhaps. I don't know if you've looked into this network at all, or so Casey Neistat, I think 2 years ago, maybe two or three years ago, started something called Beam. Beam was a way of basically holding up your phone to your chest. I think this was originally how they launched with. You hold your phone to your chest with a camera facing outwards. It records this like 10 or 20 second clip. And then it and as soon as you take it off your chest, it automatically posts it. In a way, it was a way of getting people to post very raw bits of content, either from their life or themselves and whatnot, and have it be posted. So the app, I think itself, got acquired and then got shut down by their acquisitions. It was CNN that picked it up, or it was shut down or abandoned. I'm not sure which one. But one of the reasons why I was looking into it, and I was like, you know, why did this happen? Why did it not really catch on? And I think one of the underlying reasons that I kind of came up with is that the fact that even though we do like raw pieces of people's life, you know, that we post or that we see, we do like to, we really like curation of that content itself. So even though I'm posting, let's say, a Snapchat story or an Instagram story without expecting any likes or comments back, I do want to have certain control over exactly how do I fine tune that, let's say, I don't think raw is the right word. It's like much more, authentic, right? Like authentic to this mm-hmm. experience or today's experience. And we like to curate that a little bit. So maybe yeah. how do you kind of parse the Beam network, or like, what do you think about how that kind of app itself turned out to be? How do you compare that experience, to where you think Where Thoughts Go is like, and how do you kind of handle curation as well?
Okay. So,
I know it's loaded. Beam,
yeah. No worries. The thing with Beam is, I've used it. I've played around with it. And what I think is that it's not about the people. It's about what they're looking at, which I think is one of the biggest faults. It is. It's what people are more interesting than the things they're looking at often. And I think that makes it difficult for you to create really any type of real emotional engagement with the content that is created. Where Thoughts Go, in the early stages, we're like, oh, could this be like an audio version of Reddit or something like that? And the question is, no, can't. It can't. It's the format is awful for certain types of discussion. Audio is not that great for like more analytical forms. Like asynchronous audio is not great for analytical forms more analytical exchanges. If you use Where Thoughts Go to talk about politics, you would have a very different outcome. 20% of people would not cry like they do right now with Prologue. Where Thoughts Go works because all of the topics are deeply personal. And when all of the content is deeply personal, everything becomes interesting because everything is unique, and we're all really experts on ourselves to a degree. And everything is just like highly dense and interesting. And whenever someone says something like silly or naive, you're not angry at the person. It's just part of their character. And it's an interesting fact. As if you're having a political discussion and someone says something naive, you may get angry and you may create like a negative feedback loop of behavior. So I think this is one of the key things about it that makes it work, is that it's so focused on getting people to talk about themselves and to get valuable information about them that they often don't share with the world, and put it in a place where everyone can see it.
I have a question regarding the medium that you chose, the audio one. So there is, like, for example, one big issue with audio on the internet. It's not really well machine searchable.
Right.
So, in a sense, podcasts...
it's not very indexable.
Yes, at least for now. I mean, people are trying, but this is one of the issues. The other thing that just instantly came to my mind, you mentioned that people just don't send each other, you know, long discussions over voice. I think they do. I see it all the time on the streets. Like, people develop this weird habit of speaking in their phone, then waiting 30 seconds and then holding it up to their ear and listening. So in a sense, this is happening. And I'm not particularly sure. I mean, the first thing that came to my mind when you described your product or your experience is Reddit. But then I just thought to myself, okay, hard discussions are not possible. But somehow people still tend to do those short audio bites that they send themselves anyway, right?
Oh, yes. So when you're talking to people you know, or when you're talking with those usually don't happen in like, it's just an open landscape of anonymous internet strangers. It's usually like you exchanging messages with someone else or with a group, you know, that works. That can work. And absolutely. And it's something I do. But it's like when you open a Reddit thread, for example, and you're scrolling down hundreds of comments to find out interesting things to read, you can very quickly find out what you're looking for and navigate through that content. While the audio consumption is like, you start listening, and it takes a couple seconds before you find out whether this is something you want to listen to or not. And it's like the fact that is it, you can't just quickly scroll through something and find out what you want. Audio is a much slower consumption medium when it comes for that kind of interaction. So it can work with one-to-one. You're absolutely right. And it can't work with people you know. But like at a really, really large scale asynchronous communication tool, I'm skeptical of audio being the best choice. Just to go on one tangent for a moment, I look at text, for example, as a compression algorithm. So it compresses these abstract ideas and concepts that we have into a string of words that we can move around. However, the compression is not lossless. There's loss of emotional context, tone of voice. A lot of the things that make information more humane and more emotional and more accessible. And audio retains some of that, and it loses a little bit of it's harder to index and it's harder to move around and it's slower to consume, but it does preserve a lot of that humanity. So if you create conversations and interactions that emphasize that humanity, you're utilizing the information in the best way possible, which is why Where Thoughts Go focuses only in intimate personal topics, because then all of the information is going to be infused with those qualities.
Sure. But now see, in a sense, I agree totally with you because look, we are doing a podcast right now. It's a super nice experience. We are all, I guess, listening to some podcasts. I mean, Azad mentioned before the Boost VC podcast, and I'm listening to a lot of podcasts, right? So in a sense, we love this medium for that. But a lot of listeners are usually passive. And what you're proposing is in a sense that there is like, you know, a very broad and strong anonymous communication among people, whether what at least I seem personally, intrinsically, and this might be my bias, to enjoy is meeting people who I at least expect to be with my topic. So I didn't know you before we met right now on Big Screen recording the podcast, but I somehow assume because Azad brought you in and you're doing VR and I'm doing VR, you know, we are having the same alignment at least, and I expect a nice conversation between of us. But whether it's someone strange, I feel always really awkward to just join strange, weird rooms on Big Screen and just say hi. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I'm completely anonymous, so I don't know. Maybe it's just my intrinsic bias. What's your thoughts on it?
So you're not completely alone. And here's the thing: the thing that being alone with others, that being in the room with others, changes your behavior and applies all sorts of pressures. Applies in the virtual space. So if Where Thoughts Go was something you could play with a second person, even in virtual space, would be a very different experience. People would act differently. Right. They would talk differently. The whole flow would differ. So Where Thoughts Go is really, it's designed for you to use it alone in the most isolated setting possible. And this is the first thing you see when you open the experience is like, find a room you're comfortable in, close the doors, isolate yourself, and like sit down in a comfortable position so we can take you on this journey. And yeah, it's, There's so much firing in our brain when we have other people around us. And it's like, there's just millions of years of evolution that have trained us to have all sorts of anxieties and worries, and you can create.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. It took me so long to train myself not to sit stiff in Big Screen, but actually, you know, scratch myself on some part, which I should maybe mention, and just relax because you just don't see it. And it's a great.
Yeah, especially because we don't have legs.
It took
you
a long training.
To that.
Yeah, it took me a long training. So I totally get you there.
That's kind of hilarious. I mean, if you're still holding your controller, you can kind of see like what's being scratched.
I have only one.
Okay, well, you're
he sees the 3DOF, the 3DOF controllers are scratch friendly.
I mean, I'll admit it, during some podcasts, like, you know, I need to readjust myself, and sometimes I have my controller in my hand. I'm like, should have left that controller on the table while I...
Yeah. Consistently in social settings in VR, I'm going to walk up to someone and, like, go upside down on a bed or a piece of furniture so they can see my neck twist. Very, very weird way.
That's fine.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so I think there's a few more things to kind of dive into here. Are there, with Where Thoughts Go, are there specific, not topics, but is there certain content that you encourage people to want to talk about or post? Or is it just literally like, here's a microphone and speak into it? Or like, do you want people to kind of go more into themselves? Or do you want people to use it as like a soapbox almost, or to talk about certain rants? Like, is there any kind of guideline to talking about things?
At the moment, yes. And it's structured in a linear narrative. The way that we have designed things with Prologue is that all questions are personal, and like it's 5 chapters. Each chapter is themed after a period of life, from childhood to youth to to adulthood, to late life, and to death. And each one of these has a particular topic of conversation, a particular prompt that guides the conversation in which people share about something that's themed around those periods. And what happens is that as you progress, the questions become more intimate. So you're like, as you go into the experience, you're opening up more and more with the rest of the world until something happens at the end. And so there's definitely a structure, and it is very important. It's very meaningful, especially because when you a piece like Where Thoughts Go, one of the key aspects about it is that it needs to build trust with the user. And I actually try to refrain from using the word user, and I use the word participant because the word user sure. is kind of fucked up for various reasons. But it's right. it's really or yeah. Something even. So yeah. it's like you I'm introduce them into the world, and you ask them a question that eases them in, and then you progressively go down into this this rabbit hole of emotions, and it has to be done subtly, and you can't force people to do anything. If you're trying to design trust, it's like you can listen to as many people as you want, or you can listen to no one at all. You can leave a message of any length, or you can leave an empty one, really. Nothing stops you from doing that. We don't force you to do anything, and we design it very ambiguously so people can approach it in their own way. And this helps them build trust. And it's, yeah.
Speaking of trust, I literally have right now a scenario in my mind where there's like a lonely person who is now exploring your application, and he's finding those cute voice messages from someone, and he's falling more and more in love with that person. He's like spending all his days just finding more and more messages as that person left. There's like, you know, Romeo and Julieta story. So do you think this is something that could happen? Like people, you know, kind of find each other interesting and try to find more of each other, maybe find each other through some weird ways, leaving cues for each other?
So every time you build communities, there will always be romance. It doesn't matter what kind of community it is. And the romance can range from cute to creepy. So it's the way that we're trying to, it's one of the reasons why we opted to do the one-on-one follow and things like that at it later. Cause we're like, right now we're not sure that we can do this in a way that doesn't result in bad scenarios. If it's completely random, it's hard for you to really do that. And there's definitely a dating angle to this, although we're not rushing into it at all. We're just going to keep making things that connect people, and we're going to let people guide where it should go. We don't want to become the VHS dating of VR. In case you're like really young, like back in the 80s, the dating, like you would record a tape of yourself describing yourself, and it would get distributed among a bunch of potential partners, and dating was really weird and cheesy. Stuff like that will happen. That's why we try to focus on anonymity for now. But
right,
how much do you trust in humanity? Because honestly, somehow something deep in my guts is telling me this platform will be used for fun stuff like what was this Uganda meme or Uganda knuckles or something like that, like this type of. I mean, I think that when you stripe away everything that we are trying to pretend, like we are still monkeys who like to play. And I have a feeling either you will have like only depressed people there, or it will be like completely crazy weird stuff there, or maybe a mixture of it. But I'm not sure how much do you trust in humanity?
So
to give them that power,
I think that.
Sorry, that was just so funny.
I mean, I think that people will act in the ways in which the system they're in rewards them. So I think in the case of like,
but you don't have a reward system, don't you?
That's the thing. I do have reward systems for certain things, and I don't have reward systems for others. Like, there's no. Trolling in Where Thoughts Go is a wasteful act. Like you're screaming into the void. You have no feedback loop. You don't know if you're impacting anyone. It's literally a waste of the troll's time. So it's almost like the experience loses meaning if you decide to act in a negative way like that. And I think you can design if you think like a troll. You can design the experience of a troll, and you can make it as bland and as boring as possible. And you can then, on the other end, design the ideal experience of the user who you know, plays into the systems you're making and decides to be part of that experience, and you create a really positive outcome for that person. And I think by doing that alone, people who would troll feel less compelled to troll. And you can maybe even convince trolls to do the right thing if you design it the right way. So it's like, and full disclaimer, I used to be an internet troll. I'm not proud of it, although it has allowed me to think like one. So every time, you know, when I started making this, I was like, I built it from the ground up thinking about the horrible shit people would try to do. And I designed systems that are inherently built in to not support that kind of behavior.
So you want to be a better fortune?
No. Our focus is definitely, it's not just in general communication, it's in creating deep emotional connections within people using technology. And that is a little bit ambiguous, but that's by choice. We have some things we're working on. And like my long-term goal is to create an emotional consumer electronics company, really. That's like real long-term goal. But it's, I feel like there's this emotional need that is not met by technology as a whole. And that is the product. The ways of which we reach that kind of emotional sustenance, that emotional fulfillment is, they vary, but the product is the emotion that comes out, is not the software you buy.
And how much can you harvest this data? So how much can you actually, I'm not meaning it in a bad sense, but actually in a good sense from scientific perspective, actually use the user-generated data to maybe train an algorithm or train a machine learning approach to actually be more friendly or humankind or understand concepts that people really have, you know, basically put into the system. So is it something that also crosses your mind, that the system itself might generate some meta knowledge, or is it something that you don't focus at all on?
And to add to that, you mentioned, I think, like 20% of people like cry.
Yes.
I think you mentioned a number like that, and maybe you can talk about where you get those numbers as well.
Literally by in the beginning when we're doing like heavy user testing before we make, like we tested it with a couple hundred people, and we just literally just outright asked them. And it was something that initially we weren't asking, but then we just realized that people were like asking for tissues and stuff. We're like, oh, we should start asking that and see what the rate is. And it was actually about a fifth, which is surprised us. What was the other question? Just so I can touch on that.
So how much do you expect to generate information about emotions?
I'm not thinking about that right now,
which is good.
So where thoughts go, I know it's a research goldmine. There's so much you can learn about people by observing it and seeing, you know, how people work. And like ultimately, what I'm trying to do with this is also create software that compels people to be kind, that compels people to be thoughtful and introspective, and try to make the act of reflecting something that's fun to do. This is one of the a lot of the inner goals. I think that good software, and we may not perceive this now, but I think good software should actively make you a better person, yeah. And that comes to head with some of the software that we're designing today and a lot of the services that are designed around addiction loops and stuff like that. And I think that good UX is not how much you enjoy using a product, but it's how the product integrates into your life and improves it and improves you. And it's like, I think the fact that we use the metric of how many minutes you use a day, like of an app as a metric of like the success of the application is really, really wrong. I think people should use the app,
yeah,
the amount
terrible.
Of time that it gives them fulfillment and it helps them in their day-to-day life.
Exactly.
No, I think we're big fans of like anti-dark patterns, I think, or at least identifying dark patterns within apps that we use or within the services that we use and really trying to push against it. I think that's been an overarching theme in my life this year. I think that's when I've really started realizing. And I think also phone manufacturers are starting to integrate, you know, at least usage statistics. And I think, even I noticed today, Instagram has a "you've all caught up" thing that appears in your feed at when you're scrolling down. You're like, nope, oh shit, I saw everything that I needed to see. And it kind of discourages you from scrolling further. I like that, although I don't think Instagram is like the best example of like a non-addictive app, because it clearly is. But at least it shows that people are starting to push against it a little bit.
It's just designed in a way that you can't use it for a second. You can't just use it for a minute. You're either using it for an hour, or you're not using it at all. So, or you're just posting and don't interact with people. And I think this is a difference towards your application, Lucas, right? Where you basically can interact, you don't have to, there is no pressure, but there is like an unlimited fulfillment that you're creating out of it, but nothing like an expectation, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and can I add one thing to that? I think it's very important to note, every, especially social software, like social networks, every social platform is an educational platform. It may not be what it's branded as, but the systems you create will educate people on how they should behave and on how they should think, how they should create content. And that translates into the real world. So if you look at everything you're making as an educational piece of software, I think it changes how you approach the design. You're like, and in our case, you know, we're trying to create software that compels people to be kind and introspective and thoughtful and reflective. And those are qualities that if you're able to teach that through software and have it translate into the real world, you've benefited like humanity, really, because you can
absolutely. But I have a really, really strange question. What's with augmented reality? Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean,
whatever.
Do you want to like place those things in the woods where people could actually, you know, go out of this room? Because honestly, what you describe is, you know, I lock myself in a room. And I'm like, you know, very far away from nature, very technological. And while I agree with you 100%, this could be a line of, kind of critics. Oh, yeah, you're locking people into those virtual worlds. What's about with going to the woods alone, sitting there and exploring those messages in front of you? Like, it's a whole vision.
There is a way of doing this with AR. It is not simply by putting messages in the middle of the world.
No, sure.
And it's something that, you know, when I was showing this, a lot of people, especially investors, saying like, oh, just do what Pokemon Go did and spread it around. But it's interesting because I actually thought it should work, but it doesn't. It's when you're competing with all of the noise around you, and when all of the messages exist kind of like absent of a grander context, it's hard for you to build a relationship of trust and to build a really emotional relationship with the content around you. There is a way of doing AR though, and we're exploring it.
Those GPS tracking games, right, where people hide certain things and have to, you know, follow this route on a very complex GPS stuff, and then they find the secret thing or whatever.
Yeah,
maybe that direct.
No, it's I'm going to be announcing some stuff over the next like month or two, and I'm definitely taking a very different approach to AR.
Oh, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, yeah, like slapping localization on everything is not gonna make for compelling AR. I think that whenever everyone's doing like, and that applies to like Hollywood and film and games and lots of things, whenever everyone is going big, it's like the solution for this medium is for us to create this huge ass game. It usually means that you have to go smaller and you have to like take a step back and create something that's really small and really meaningful and has a real like new source of value that you can then expand. Does that make sense?
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It's like the blockbuster versus the indie film that decides to do something really small and interesting, but manages to create like really, really meaningful emotions and a new format out of it.
And is it something that drives your motivation towards being so skeptical towards a lot of VR applications? So when we entered big screen, you were like, oh, it's actually better than I expected.
Yes. So I'm very hard on myself. And I end up being also hard on the industry at large. I wanted to move as quickly as I wanted to move, and I want people to embrace certain values and the way they design things that that I think should be standard. So I'm always surprised to see something that's good. And in the case of big screen, it like there's some cool elements. It embraces physicality. You can grab things. You can interact with. We can see each other and. It's responsive and it's cool and it works well. And the desktop integration is something that was particularly interesting. So it always makes me happy to see applications that are really cool and that are doing unique things. And big screen has some unique things about it. I tend to think that most of VR is really tame right now, for the most part, is people are scared of doing weird stuff. That you have, which is why actually most of the innovation I've been seeing in VR is happening in the art space. It's when I go to like these exhibitions or galleries or film festivals, and you see people using the medium and like, whoa, I've never seen anyone do this before. I want to see more boldness. I want to see more crazy stuff. And I want to see people using the medium in new ways.
Yeah, I think that's a sentiment I can agree with as well. And having spoken to some investors, that is also something that you hear from them. It's like that. It's even some of them that have been in it since the beginning. They're like, Tipitak comes to mind. He's like, I want people to push it more. Like we still keep getting like kind of bland pitches or like really obvious things, and there's not as much. Like, we want to see more experimental ideas, and I think Where Thoughts Go can definitely falls into that experimental category.
Thank you.
I do. No, of course. So I kind of going back a couple minutes to, I guess, focusing on trolling as well. I think that's an interesting concept that you touched on, and especially it's like super relevant because anonymity. God, I still can't say it. And trolling are somewhat connected, and I think you're right? It's the feedback of your action that is what encourages trolling. However, I think there's some things I need to ask you about that. So VR at this point is obviously still small in scale and doesn't really have the huge scale that can also create problems. I think VR, we've talked about this in the before. VR chat has experienced that and is constantly they have scale now because it's a application that lives also outside of VR. And at a certain point, let's say if it catches on to a big train of people and users, suddenly you're flooded with 3,000 people from one website, or let's say 30,000 people. If you do have a site like 4chan, and 4chan is known for doing this, for rating on poll, to raid a poll and to like have a very silly answer, let's say Hitler become like the most used one, right? Like typically it's for haha purposes or whatever, or actually Bodhi Boatface is also a result of that.
Oh my gosh. But this is a good one.
I know that's a funny one.
Some people died.
But
some people were driven into suicide also. So I mean, the fun part is fun, but
I agree. I mean, obviously I'm just kind of concentrating on some of the mm-hmm. examples, but let's say this, right? Like if, even though there isn't the feedback loop of like, oh, people are reacting negatively to me trolling, but if you have a massive group of people wanting to go in there to spew hate and to essentially flood the creatures and the thought bubbles that you'll be encountering, to most of them being very negative or racist, like isn't that a goal that can be achieved by a group of nefarious people? I know I'm pushing an edge case and
no,
I'm pushing
it's,
like
it's totally fine
thing, but are there any kind of like of safeguards against that, or would that require manual kind of curation? If like, I don't know if you guys are curating any of the thought bubbles leaving behind, or if you have a certain how do you deal with curation?
So to that point, I think that to design software that compels people to be better people, we need to design the experience of the worst people. And 4chan raids, I was thinking about them from day one. Like, seriously, I was like, okay,
right.
So we're building this, and if we get popular, this is definitely going to happen. Like, there's no way around it. I absolutely know that there will be a group of people that it doesn't matter how well you design the systems, you can greatly reduce them to a much more manageable amount of people, which is why I don't even know how, to be honest. It's like, there's no instances of trolling yet. As of the release product, there's zero. And I didn't think that would happen. I would think it would be a much lower number, but I didn't think it would be zero. But it's also because we're starting small, and there's a price tag behind it. So the moment you pay for Where Thoughts Go Prologue, you're more emotionally committed to it and to the experience. And we're going to be slowly building up and opening up things and more. And there's a free experience here, free experience there. And we're going to build up our way into a moment in which we feel comfortable to open things more fully too. So it's less guided, and it's less of a guided experience, and it's more the internet as is. So we're building up to that, and I'm thinking about 4chan raids from day one. As for curation and how that's handled, it's changing all the time internally, and it's one of the key parts of the stuff that we're making. So I'm not going to be talking too much about it until like we have, because I don't want to keep contradicting myself in the next couple of months.
Sure.
So, but there's definitely an element of there's some automatic moderation that happens that covers like extreme use cases. And then there's a dose of manual moderation that happens when necessary. That's kind of like how it's structured right now. So most cases we're not going to need any humans in the process, but some cases we do need people, and that's fine at a VR scale because you don't have hundreds of millions of people using VR. That won't be fine in the future. So we need to build up those technologies and those systems so we get to a place in which we're protected against that.
And particularly, it's not just about getting rid of trolls. It's also legal problems. I mean, wasn't there recently a case where someone was putting child pornography in a blockchain, and through that, the blockchain itself from the Bitcoin became illegal in some countries? And in a sense, particularly when you operate on a global scale, I mean, different countries have different... different rights and different legal bases, and sometimes just having a copyright song there might give you trouble. Sometimes, as you know, when you notice you take it down, it's fine. So in a sense, it's like very diverse towards the global scale. And that's also my question, maybe how do you plan to scale up to the world? Is it already available in every country, and how do you prepare to be ready for those legal issues that might come up when you become the next Facebook? It's obviously right now you're under the radar, but some point.
So what kind of legal issues exactly? I'm a little...
So let's say I'm putting some kind of copyright material instead of saying something and just, play a song. Or I actually, say that, someone is stupid, we need to kill him, and then he's being killed or something like that. So some, really mean and awful things that have some kind of real life consequences, or any racism stuff, right? Someone is being racist and you have it there. And I mean, in Germany, at least, or in European Union, there is some kind of system where you can get notified and then you have to take it down, and they're playing with automated filters and whatever. But in a sense, when you're having a platform, even though it's anonymous, it doesn't grant you necessarily the liability to, say, okay, I'm guilt free in all of the countries in the world.
Yeah. And it's also one of the key things about the kind of content that Orthodox Go is, due to the personal nature of it, is that it's not tied to a particular point in time. So it's not like if content is not posted at the moment it's submitted, it does not lose relevance. When someone's talking about childhood dreams, that's as relevant now as it will be in 5 years or 10. So it gives us, it actually gives us time to process these things and to find out, to find out the best systems and what to let in and what not to let in, and how to communicate that with people. So that's actually one of the advantages of the format, and something we've been focusing on, and also why I haven't been focusing on it as a pure just as a communication tool. It's a very particular type of communication that can have those benefits. And examples of people telling each other to kill themselves and stuff like that, that's easy to detect. And if you upload something that's not a human voice, that's also easy to detect. And if it's if somebody tries to upload porn or something like that, it's again, it's also, it gets to a point that it's like it's not that difficult, and you can there's definitely some challenges for that kind of scale, and there it does beg the question of how long can you go on without having any sort of user accounts. If you're working at a platform level like that, there may be a moment in which you're like, okay, it's still anonymous, but it's kind of like Reddit in the sense that email, password, you can create a new email if you want for it to be a throwaway account. But just so we can start tracking behavior. So new people, we watch a little more carefully. And as you build a reputation, it's like, okay, we trust you. And we start looking at the other people.
Sure. I think it's just important. Maybe this is... Okay, sorry. Yeah, no, sorry. I have a delay here. Yeah, go on. No, just... just go for it.
Okay. So to kind of end things on a positive note, perhaps, after putting you through the edge cases and things, you mentioned earlier that you've been encountering thoughts and memories that you didn't really expect to. What have you been kind of encountering that's surprising to you that you consider to be positive?
So the most surprising thing that happened is right about on chapter 4 in Where Thoughts Go Prologue, not to spoil the prompt, because those like are the key narrative beats. Hold on, I'm trying to think of how to talk about this in a non-spoiler-ish way. There may not be spoilers for the next 60 seconds, possibly. Light spoilers. So there is... Thank you for the sound effect. So there is there's a moment in the experience in which people started leaving messages to people that they lost, addressing them directly. That was not by design. I did not ask them to do it. But when given the opportunity, some people were like, you know, talking to like their father that died 5 years ago and just like literally talking to them and leaving a message and going away. And they were using the experience as an opportunity to talk to people they couldn't talk to. It happened not just once. It's happening multiple times, which shows that there is a need, and like it's just another kind of emotional need that is unfulfilled by the world and by technology. It's like people just want to talk. And there's some other stories of like I had a friend who actually lost a parent, and he would still text the parent on the phone to tell him about things. He got really pissed 3 months later when AT&T like canceled the phone account and he couldn't message the person anymore. It was interesting. It was surprising. And I think it shows that once you focus on a particular kind of communication and when focusing on addressing a particular emotional need, all sorts of interesting things can happen. And yeah, it's just, it made me cry a lot, but it's really cool that people are doing it. And it's healthy to do it, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I had the last time I cried in VR was during the Anne Frank VR house experience. Super good. And I'm kind of afraid of trying your experience, to be honest, because I might, you know, lose a few drops here and there too, because apparently VR has a good touch on me. I was avoiding everything that is scary and sad for so long, and apparently for a good reason, it works very well on me.
Yeah, and it's funny. Sorry, go on.
No, please.
It's just that you mentioned Tipitat, and he has tried the experience like when it was like at a prototype level, and we had this discussion. Like he doesn't think that it actually utilizes the full capabilities of VR. While I believe that the experience only works at that level while in VR, and I just want to take the opportunity to say that a lot of the value of virtual reality is it's kind of invisible. It's the stuff that happens in your head. It's the relationships you're building with content. Mm-hmm. It's the things you're feeling. It's how your brain is responding to the information rather than just the mechanics. So technically, with Where Thoughts Go, the act of listening to other people and recording messages, you could pull that off on any type of device. But the fact that we use virtual reality to build a relationship of trust and to help you build a relationship with other people and connect emotionally and get in a certain headspace, and the fact that you start to build a connection also with the places you're in, it kind of tells your brain that this is a real place that you go to have this kind of social interaction. So it's like you go into this virtual world and you adjust your brain framework to like, I'm going to interact in this way with these people and have this kind of emotional interaction. And I think that kind of emotional design was never possible before. That's one of the key things VR is amazing at, but it is non-obvious and it happens on the back of our heads.
And you need to experience it.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a cool point. To kind of respond to Peter's kind of comment about the Anne Frank. It's funny you had such an emotional reaction to it. I actually had a very opposite reaction to that, where I actually went into that app expecting... I went into it with a very technical framework, and I thought I went into it expecting to look at photogrammetry of the house, and I went in and I first of all realized, oh, this is first of all 3D model, and second of all not 6 degrees of freedom in a Rift experience, and then that totally threw off my expectations, and I was like, and then I went through it like not wanting to. Like I went into it like a tech demo, like look, trying to find good examples of photogrammetry, and I didn't find it. So, and then, I mean, having you, and then when I think I saw your tweet or somewhere that you had posted, I think it was on our Discord, where you had a very emotional reaction to it. I was like, you know, like I even posted about it on our Discord, being like, this isn't that great. Like it's a 3DoF experience and a 6DoF headset. Like what the hell? But I think it's all about the framework that you go into an experience. I think it's such a huge factor of what defines how you feel about it.
And the crazy part is also what you're using. So I was really, before I got the stupid Oculus Go, really against it. I always thought, you know, 3 degrees of freedom, so limiting, blah, blah, blah. But honestly, like, it limits you so much that you focus on the goddamn experience. You don't expect great graphics. Yeah. You don't expect great content. And when it's good, it's just fine. Yeah. So, I mean, on a PC, I expect, you know, super sampling, 300%. Every pixel is damn sharp. And when there's an anti-aliasing error, I just gotta give it 1 star. But on Oculus Go, I'm way more, you know, forgiving.
I actually, that's such a great point. When they have the experience and down to just, like, put on the headset and you have the controller, you don't have to worry about Gear VR and whatnot, all those issues. You just focus on the content. And even though the tech specs, which I think a lot of PC people, right, it's all about the specs of your computer. Yes, the RAM, like the GPU,
the RAM.
But it's like, fuck all of that. just fuck all the specs.
32.
And concentrate on content. Yeah, that's a really excellent point.
Yeah, which is why I think that for you to have emotional connections, the technology needs to be invisible. Which is why I'm actually so...
Zoom.
Yeah, which is why I'm so...
Zero.
Anti-realism, and why I think that the weakest point of social VR right now is that there's lots of human-like characters. I think that it's when you try to replicate the real world, you will always come off underwhelming. You can never match it, and we were trained for decades to learn what the real world looks like, what real people look like, and it's just a constant reminder that we're not in the real place. Unless you're able to create photorealistic VR, but that's going to take up decades to achieve in the truly photorealistic level. Which is why I think when you design your aesthetic and when you design your rules and you're creating a new world that does not answer to the rules of the real world, you can make people forget, and they're not going to be comparing it with things at the back of our mind all the time, and you're going to be more willing to surrender. So I think we should be doing more of that.
And just I know we're running low on time, but you also you built a lot of the assets of Where Thoughts Go in VR, right?
Yes. I started doing it actually on the second half of development. I wish I could do it from day one, and I'm trying to do it from day one now. But a lot of the assets were built using Google Blocks, using a level editor called Tavori, which is also an amazing animation tool. I did try using the Unity Editor XR, like the VR editor in Unity, but it was the frame rate was unbearable. A couple months back, it may be better now, and it's a really promising tool. Designing in VR is just so much faster, and like with Where Thoughts Go right now, I'm in the process of building, so like all of the administration systems and panels and stuff like that. I'm in the process of building them in Unity, so these activities could all be done in VR instead of like in a 2D screen. And yeah, I think it's going to be like a company rule. Everything you do, you should be able to do it in VR and in a particularly engaging way. Because VR is great for focus.
Yeah.
It removes
not great for everything yet.
Yeah.
with productivity, but I think there's clearly, like, over the course of all the podcasts that we've done, we've been trying to dig into with every company, kind of like what value they're really pulling out of VR, even when it comes to the development side. And I think, I mean, it's not a perfect thing, obviously, because in the beginning you talked about how you're trying to do a lot of development out of VR and without having to put on your headset on and off, you know, 5 times in a minute. But anyway, Lucas, how can people find you? How can people contact you, and where can people find Where Thoughts Go?
Oh, quick question. Do you know the particular, like, HTML character that's like, it's like an underline? What's the actual English term for that? Underscore. Yes, there you go. Cool. Just want to check in. So
5 points of Gryffindor.
Yes. Oh, so you're Gryffindor. No. Oh, what is it? What's your house?
I'm a broom.
Wait. Your broom. That's your Hogwarts house.
I'm a broom. Yes.
That sounds like Hufflepuff.
Yeah. Just let's move on. Ignore this moment before someone wants to ride me.
Yeah, you can find Where Thoughts Go right now in the Oculus store. It's on early access. And it's a pretty great experience on its own right now. It's going to be out on the HTC Vive and Windows Mixed Reality pretty soon, probably first week of August. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook. My username on Twitter is _ Lucas Risotto, LucasRizotto, which should be at the title of the podcast. And yeah, make thoughtful, bold, immersive stuff, because we're really, intentionally or not, we're designing the future of the internet.
Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. And you can find us on Twitter at ResearchVRcast. You can find us on Discord as well. We just passed the 100 mark. I think we're almost at 110 Yay! Now. It's awesome. That was our goal when we started it a few months ago. It's actually been a really awesome community. Like, that's where we've been sharing a lot of news about science that we find. Actually, that's also where our guests have been joining us after the podcast to have, like, post-episode discussions or pre-episode discussions. So you'll find a good high quality range of users there. And that's also where we are announcing, like, really short term meetups and, like, show and tell. So we had an impromptu one like a month or so ago, where we met up in Big Screen in a big room, and we were all kind of talking about our work or showing our work on the big screen. I think we want to do another one this week, Peter, this Saturday. Uh-oh. I know this is when you hear this, it's probably already passed. So, if you don't,
well, you have to be on the Discord.
That's
channel.
Exactly. That's where you'll know. So this Saturday, we're going to have another meet and greet, and I'll probably be showing a little bit of some of the photogrammetry work that I've done. The thing I did in Utah, the Mars Desert Research Center that I went to the middle of Utah to scan, and some of the volumetric filmmaking stuff. I'll actually be in New York next week to speak at the Volumetric Filmmakers meetup. So that's going to be really fun. Nice. So anyway, yeah, keep up with us on Twitter and on Discord, and sometimes we post the highlight clips on YouTube as well. So thank you all again for listening. Thank you, Lucas, for joining us on this podcast. This has been a really awesome and fruitful discussion on experience design and anonymity. God, one day I'll learn how to say that word correctly, but that day is not today.
Oh, can I do one little shout out?
Yeah.
We're looking for people who want to do research in the stuff we're doing, and we're willing to, like, cooperate and create, like, custom experiences so people can play and learn. We think there's a lot of thoughtful things happening with the brain, and we would love to understand what they actually, you know, on the note of research, we'd love to understand what's actually happening, so we're not just moving by intuition anymore. Cool.
No, that's a cool call out. We do have a lot of our audience members are people that are interested in these subjects and are perhaps researchers themselves. That would be really cool if maybe they can contact you through either Twitter, or maybe you can meet them on the Discord. That'll be fun. Anyway,
yes.
Anyway, guys, thank you all for listening again, and we'll see you guys next time.
Woo!
Hey.